Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Imagine this. Imagine that you're in a restaurant and your server comes up to the table and says, "We have a wonderful special for you tonight. We have a great deal on Patagonian toothfish." Now, you may well hear that, and maybe you're very adventurous and you say, "I'll try that." You might also say, "Somehow that doesn't sound particularly appealing." And then the server says, "Well, how about some nice Chilean sea bass?" And then you say, "Oh, okay, I've heard of that. That's all right. Let's go with that." Well, the fact is that Chilean sea bass is Patagonian toothfish. It's a fish that for a long time no one seemed really interested in eating until someone, a fish merchant from the United States, discovered it, renamed it, promoted it, and it has become very popular. In fact, it's become so popular that some people are concerned about the future of the species, the Patagonian toothfish. We'll talk about that, have that story for you, as well as the story of the effort to crack down on illegal fishing of this particular fish, and in the process, look at the story of what was the longest maritime chase in history. All of this is told in a newly published book. It's titled Hooked: Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by the Rodale Press by Bruce Necht. He is a New York-based writer for the Wall Street Journal. His work has also been published in The Atlantic Monthly and Condé Nast Traveler and The New York Times Magazine. He is the author of an earlier book, The Proving Ground, which is about competitive blue water sailing, concentrating on the 1998 Sydney to Hobart race. He's a sailor himself, and he's joining us by telephone. And questions and comments are certainly welcome. As we talk, you can be a part of the conversation by calling us 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, folks. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Necht, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks for talking with us.
Sure, my pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. So this starts here, at least the story of the Chilean sea bass, as we know. It starts back in the mid-1970s, and this fellow, he was from Los Angeles, happened to be in Chile, and he was looking for fish to be able to market and saw this particular fish, and he had never seen one before, and he said, "What's that?"
He did. What he saw was a gruesome-looking, enormous fish, close to 100 pounds. You mentioned its name is Patagonia toothfish. It does have these enormous teeth. And he saw it on the first one he saw was on a fishing vessel, and he was sort of pushed to the side of the other fish. And he saw another one in the central market a couple days later, and he started asking about it. And what he found was that it was an accidental catch, that no one in Chile really knew what to do with it. They didn't think it was something that humans would want to eat because it has this enormous oil content. Somebody tried to sort of dye it orange and inject this sort of smoke-like chemical into it and try to pawn it off as smoked salmon, but that didn't work very well. But Lee thought this fish might have possibilities in spite of all that in the American market.
Yeah, and he apparently reasoned that, well, for one thing, that even if a fish is unattractive, it doesn't matter what it looks like when it's in the whole fish. When you get it on the table, that's the important thing. And apparently he thought that people in North America, and perhaps people elsewhere, they wouldn't have any problem with the taste. They would think that it was fine. So people want some places eat stuff and other places they don't. So he thought, well, this is something he could do something with.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, it's the subtitle of the book is The Perfect Fish, and I say that because in many ways it is the perfect fish. Americans like white flesh fish. It's flaky. You can cook it any way you like it. It's almost impossible to overcook it. You can add whatever spices you like, and it kind of takes on the flavor, in part because it doesn't have a whole lot of flavor of its own. It's not a fish that tastes fishy. So for all those reasons, plus one more, it took off. It took a while, but it eventually took off. The one other reason is it's such a resilient fish that you could cook it this afternoon. Let's say you're a caterer and you need to cook up 100 portions of some fish for an event tonight. You could cook it in the afternoon. You could put it on the shelf. Then you could reheat it before you put it on the table, and it still tastes good. Now, that's very unusual, as you know, for a fish, and what has made it so, part of what has made it so popular.
As you say, though, it took a little time to catch on. Initially, I think you're right that the people who were using it were Asian restaurants. Cantonese restaurants were using it as a substitute for something else that they were familiar with that was more expensive, and that they found that they could use this. It would work in the dishes that they were using, and it wouldn't cost them as much.
Yeah, no, its beginnings were quite slow. I mean, when Lee Lentz first started bringing it into the States, no one would buy it, even though he was offering to sell it for $1, $1.25 a pound. His first sale, somebody used it for frozen fish fingers, hardly a great beginning for a fish that became sort of a gourmet favorite. But then, as you say, Chinese restaurants, they started substituting it for black cod or sable because that was much more expensive. And then it was a few years down the road when sort of the fine restaurants, the better-known seafood restaurants, first on the West Coast and then on the East Coast and then everywhere else, discovered the virtues of the fish, and that's when it really took off.
Yeah, it became really big in New York restaurants. Is it the Tribeca Grill? Was that the one that was...
The very first restaurant that I found that was serving it was actually the Four Seasons restaurant, which is, the big, power brokers of Manhattan. That would probably be considered their favorite place to have lunch. And the interesting thing there, they put it on the menu in 1990. I couldn't find any restaurant in New York who had it before that. And they didn't call it Chilean sea bass. They didn't call it Patagonia toothfish. They called it Corvina bass, which is really bizarre because Chilean sea bass is not a bass. It's not a sea bass. And Corvina is a type of fish. Well, Patagonia toothfish is not a Corvina either. So they mixed together two names of two different types of fish and called the Patagonia toothfish that name, even though the Patagonia toothfish is neither a Corvina or a bass. It didn't matter. It became a huge best-selling dish at the restaurant where it remained on the menu for many years.
Mm. So the important thing here is that when the fish took off in popularity, there was now a great demand for the toothfish or whatever it is that you want to call it. And that's what gets us into sort of this other story and connects with concerns that people have about not only this kind of fish, but a lot of other fish, concerns about overfishing. What happened once the interest in the toothfish or the Chilean sea bass took off? What did that do for demand for the fish?
Well, not surprisingly, the demand skyrocketed, as did the price, and therefore so did the rewards to the people who were fishing for it. Now, some people who fish for Patagonia toothfish are legal, which is to say they have permits. Many others aren't. A very high percentage of the fish that arrives in this country is caught illegally. And fleets of fishing vessels, and we're talking about industrialized fishing vessels that use long lines that have 15,000 baited hooks and can stretch for a dozen miles or longer. These are vessels that can catch 10, 20, even 30 tons of Chilean sea bass in a single day. And often they work in tandem with other vessels. So you have two or three or four vessels, catching 10, 20, 30 tons a day. Well, it doesn't take very long before there's no more fish. It's I call it in the book strip mining, and that's really what it is.
And now, I think that generally there has been some attention devoted to this idea of overfishing, and we've seen various kinds of species driven to the brink of extinction. Cod, for example, has had some serious trouble. It's perhaps doing a little bit better, but there are concerns about the future of cod, and there are other fish as well, because the demand generally for fish has gone up so much. So this is one, in this particular case, I think people have actually tried to put some attention on this, and as a result, some chefs at some restaurants, some places have said, we're not going to serve Chilean sea bass. I get the problem here. We won't do that. But has that actually put much of a dent in the demand for the fish?
The demand is still high. What it has done is raise public awareness. I'm sure many of the people listening today are familiar with the Take a Pass on Chilean Sea Bass campaign. And many of the better-known, better-regarded restaurants have taken it off the menu. But unfortunately, the places that serve it in much higher quantities, the caterers, the hotels, the banquet halls, cruise ships, the places where this the unique values of the fish are particularly important, they haven't taken off their menus, and those are places that serve it in much greater quantities.
Let me introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Bruce Necht. He's a New York-based writer for the Wall Street Journal and is the author of this book, Hooked: Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by the Rodale Press. He's also written a really interesting book about competitive sailing at a high level, The Proving Ground. That's the book. Still out now. You certainly can find it. And the new one as well. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You talked about the fact that it is possible to fish legally for toothfish, but that also a large percentage of the toothfish that come into the United States are caught illegally. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the legal catch and the illegal catch?
Well, illegal just means that the people catching it didn't have a permit. You know, it's no different from you or I going to a lake somewhere where we're supposed to have a permit to catch some fish, and we could either go get the permit or we could say, oh, well, too much trouble, or maybe they won't give it to us. Let's not bother. And the pirates that I write about, the pirate fishermen I write about, were in that category. They didn't have a permit to fish near Heard Island, which is where the chase begins. And Heard Island is a very obscure part of the world. It's halfway between the west coast of Australia and Cape Town, South Africa, a few hundred miles north of Antarctica. The island belongs to Australia. Australia claims the exclusive right to fish within 200 miles of the island, as all nations do these days, claim that right around their territory. And there are two fishing vessels that have the right to fish there, and the others are operating illegally.
So it is the nations who fishing in what they consider to be their national waters, they're the ones that issue the permits for the legal fishing.
Exactly. And, you know, the bad guys in the story, if we can call them that, they're from other countries, typically Spain. Spain is the greatest nation of fishermen the world has ever seen. And, you know, they are kind of in a bad position in that most of the fisheries that they have worked in for, you know, centuries are so depleted that, you know, it's not worth fishing there anymore. So they've expanded their realm to include places like Heard Island, and they think it's unfair that they don't have a shot at fishing in places like that. They think the laws are not about protecting fish. They think these laws are about protecting domestic fishermen who are not nearly as good as they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other part of the story here has to do with this chase, where an Australian patrol boat, the Southern Supporter, is in this area, and they see another ship that they clearly suspect is a fishing vessel, and clearly suspect that this vessel is there, and they're fishing illegally. So what happens?
Yeah, you would be unlikely to be in this part of the world. It's not on the way to any place else if you weren't fishing. It's difficult to come up with a scenario that would have a boat there if it wasn't involved in fishing. And the fish that are there are the Patagonia titfish. It's one of their prime habitats. So the vessel was spotted electronically. The patrol boat began to move in quickly, hoping to get there quickly enough that they would get evidence of fishing. And now, evidence when it comes to fishing means a photograph of gear in the water, or it might mean collecting gear from the water that can be connected in a legal sense to the boat from which it came. It's not easy to do. And that's what the Australians attempted to do. They at high speed pursued the boat. The Vyarsa, that's the pirate vessel that ran immediately south, which is to say towards Antarctica, and within a day it was swallowed up in an enormous storm, hurricane force winds and 40-foot waves, and that began the chase.
Mm-hmm. So this is what the fact that they could have stopped the Vyarsa and boarded it and found that their hold was stuffed full of toothfish, that wouldn't have been enough for them to be charged with illegal fishing?
No, because the fishermen could claim, as they eventually did claim, that the fish came from someplace else, that they were caught on the high seas, you know, where there is no regulation of fishing. You know, unfortunately for the law enforcement folks, it is possible to find Patagonia toothfish on the high seas. So that leaves open the opportunity for fishermen who are not operating legally to claim that whatever is found on their vessel came from the high seas, when in all likelihood it's not. It's highly improbable that it came from the high seas because the fish are just so, you know, less plentiful there.
Yeah. And this, when I don't know what sort of image people have if you talk about a fishing boat, but this boat, the Viarsa, is an industrial kind of an industrial sort of operation. If you look at the kind of volume that they're capable of catching and processing and holding, we're talking about an enormous amount of fish.
Yeah, I mean, they'll catch their 10, 20 or more tons of fish a day. As the fish come up on the long line, they are taken off the hook. They're dropped down a chute. They go into what they call a factory. It's not really a factory. It's all about taking the fish apart. And there's a circular saw that takes off their heads and tails. The guts are taken out, and they're put into a freezer hold. And within 2 or 3 months, the hold is filled with about 300 tons of fish. Now, this is obviously all about money. And just so we're clear on the economics of this, this fish, 300 tons of it, is worth $3 million, $3 or $3.5 million. And the boat itself, we could go out and buy the Arsa for $1.5 million. So at a time when fishing as an industry is marginally profitable, this fish has incredible profitability, so much that at the end of one voyage, you've paid your capital investment of buying the ship and have plenty of money left over. Mm. And, of course, the ship to do it again.
So you could see why somebody providing they had the means would want to get in this business, and also you could see why it is that the authorities would like to try to catch them and keep them from doing this, so you could understand both why they would run, why they would not want to be caught, and also why the Australians would go after them.
Absolutely. I mean, the incentives, the person on a fishing vessel, whether it's a legal or illegal, who's in charge is the fishing master. You know, people assume that the captain is in charge. The captain on a fishing vessel like this really becomes more like the truck driver who goes where the fishing master tells him to. And the fishing master is compensated according to what they gather, what they get in terms of money. Typically, in the case of the Viarsa, the fishing master, a guy named Antonio Perez, was paid an amount equal to 5% of what they sold the fish for. So if you sold it for $3 million, he made $150,000 in the space of 2 or 3 months.
Pretty good. Yeah, it's pretty good. Well, though, given you can understand the motivation of the Australians in wanting to apprehend these people, but given the fact, as you explained before, that it's very difficult to get the evidence sufficient to charge them, that is, you have to catch them in the act. You can't just stop the boat and say, I see that your hold here is full of toothfish, you're under arrest. So, and given that, and the chances that they're actually going to get the goods on these guys, you might ask, well, why did the Australians bother? I mean, why did they give chase, continue to chase over this very long distance, and put their vessel at risk, because this was no easy chase, given that once they caught the guys, if indeed they caught the Viarsa, that there might be some question about whether they could have a successful prosecution.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It was an incredibly difficult chase. I mean, when they got close to Antarctica, the Viarsa operating at the command of the fishing master, Antonio Perez, basically took a right-hand turn and when it couldn't go any further, and then proceeded, you know, through an obstacle course of icebergs, and the sea itself began to freeze, and it was sort of a game of cat and mouse that continued halfway around Antarctica, you know, 4,000 miles. I should say, by the way, you said at the outset it's the longest chase in nautical history. It's the longest one I ever have heard of. I didn't actually say it was the longest in the book because I was afraid that somebody listening to a show like this would say, oh no, the British Navy in, you know, 1893, you know, chased somebody, you know, 7,000 miles. But it's certainly one of the longest, and you know, an epic chase that in Australia was front page news, you know, for the three weeks that it was going on, which frankly is part of the reason I was interested in the book, because here this chase is all about catching some people who catch a fish that is destined for the American market, but yet we never really even heard about this chase. It didn't really capture any news attention here, even though it was, you know, so prominently covered in Australia.
Yeah, well, that's interesting.
Where they don't eat the fish, by the way.
That would explain why, you know, I always, when I do these things, I always go looking for reviews of the books, and there were a number of reviews in the Australian newspapers. I think your book probably got more attention in Australia so far, at least, than it's gotten in the United States, and I guess that would explain why. Because
it's doing okay. It was on the Today Show, and Tom Brokaw, who's a great fisherman, said it's the best book he's read in years. So it's getting some attention, but you're right. In Australia, this is a story that's familiar to people, and sea chases of bad guys around obscure parts of the world. Well, that kind of happens more in Australia than it does here.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people who think, who are interested in any kind of story that involves boats, and blue water sailing in any way. So I think it's a good story, and getting an endorsement from old Tom probably doesn't hurt. And so the effort of the Australian ship, the Southern Supporter, back in Australia, the people of Australia said go, and the government of Australia said go. Everybody back home was saying, yeah, go ahead and see, you know, go after these guys and catch them if you can.
Yep, absolutely.
We are at our midpoint here and talking with Bruce Nacht. He is a New York-based writer for The Wall Street Journal, has published work in The Atlantic Monthly and Condé Nast Traveler, The New York Times Magazine. He's author of The Proving Ground, which is a book about the 1998 Sydney to Hobart sailboat race. He's a sailor himself and has a new book out now that's all about fishing, illegal fishing in this particular case, for the Patagonian toothfish, which is better known to restaurant goers in the United States and other places, as well as the Chilean sea bass. The title of the book is Hooked: Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by the Rodale Press. It's out now in bookstores if you would like to look at it. And if you'd like to call in here, we're certainly open to questions. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, the boat, the Vyarsa, eventually was caught with the help of Britain and South Africa in particular. And it was in large part because South Africa had armed commandos literally board the boat and take it that way. Can you tell that story?
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem the Australians had was the patrol boat had a crew that was not armed. And so their threats to the Vyarsa and its crew were not really heated, so Australia had needed to get some armed personnel somehow, and as they continued to head west around Antarctica, the obvious choice was South Africa. So what they did was they made an arrangement with the South African government to hire a bunch of security guards, who unfortunately many of them had never been to sea before, to conduct an armed boarding, which was ultimately accomplished after a great deal of difficulty.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the boat was apprehended, the crew were apprehended, they were charged, there was a trial. I know you probably don't want to give away too much of what happens in the book. Was there a successful prosecution?
Well, I won't tell you what happened exactly, but I will tell you that Antonio Perez, who I got to know fairly well during the course of the trial, which was quite valuable because he has a very interesting perspective on all this, he sent me an email a few weeks ago and told me about the new fishing vessel that he had and how he would be out fishing before too long. In fact, I suspect he's out fishing for Patagonia toothfish right now.
Hmm. So that raises the question ultimately just whether it's possible to stop pirate fishing from a law enforcement point of view, you know, given the fact that the ocean is a big place, it's difficult to catch them, it's difficult to have a successful prosecution. And perhaps as long as demand continues to be what it is, then you have to wonder whether this is really something that that's going to go on, whether we like it or not, and in spite of a lot of people's best efforts to stop it.
I agree. It's very hard to be optimistic, and I don't think people generally know how bad it is. And I was one of those people before I started working on the book. You know, I had read articles that said that most of the fish we like to eat are, you know, their populations are less than 10% of what they were 50 years ago. But I think I didn't really believe that, in part because when you go to the fish market or a supermarket, you will see lots of fish there. And part of the reason for that is that the fish that used to be there, say, 50 years ago, those fish typically came from relatively nearby bodies of water, wherever you happen to be. Now the fish come from much further places, places we're not very familiar with, and that's certainly the case with the Patagonia toothfish. And often they come from the southern hemisphere. So if you went to a fish market with an expert, and something I did and wrote about, and ask the expert to go through fish by fish what it is, where it comes from, it's quite remarkable about what's happened. The fish that used to be there are gone. The new fish are some of them are farmed, some of them are from the southern hemisphere, but it happened so gradually that we didn't really notice it. If there was a snapshot of 50 years ago and then today of a fish market, we would say, wow, it's a whole new cast of characters. But we didn't really see it. You know, you mentioned cod earlier. You know, the population of cod is probably, 5% of what it was 50 years ago. But, you know, a decade ago it was 2.5 or 3% of what it was. So some people say, oh, well, its population has doubled. Let's go fishing. Well, of course, that sort of also obscures the truth about what's happening.
Yeah, and it's when you go into the fish market today, I think that you'll end up seeing, you'll see things that you hadn't seen before. That's because they've had to go out and find other things to meet the demand. And now also, I think that probably means that people are now eating things that they didn't eat before, that maybe in some cases were not fit for, said to me, not fit for human consumption before, but now because the demand is there, the fish are there and people are saying, well, okay, I can eat that. And maybe it has to do with how you prepare it, or maybe it just has to do with what you're used to.
That's very true. There's a prominent fishery scientist who calls this fishing down the food web, which is to say as the big top predator fish becomes scarcer, we begin to consider eating things like smelts and which I think probably some of your listeners are familiar with, they're not so bad to eat, but they were considered at one point a fish that nobody wanted to eat. Now they're becoming popular.
He says
it's going to lead to when all the fish are gone. He talks about jellyfish sandwiches. I'm not sure we'll never get to that point, but that is one of the impacts.
Yeah,
the other thing is that wealthy societies, wealthy people, they can afford to pay what it takes to get the last fish. So there'll still be fish, but the overall population seems likely to dwindle, and that's a lost opportunity, because if the fish populations were higher, we could catch more fish than we are now, and we could do it forever on a sustainable basis.
Let's talk with a caller, someone listening in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I was thinking jellyfish and peanut butter. You're talking about sandwiches. Just curiosity, what kind of money does these licenses bring in, for fishing? Is it based on just pay for the license, or do they have to pay for the tonnage or not?
Well, that's an interesting question, and you'll be surprised by the answer. They pay nothing for the license, and they own it for perpetuity. I'm talking about the company that has the legal right to fish for Patagonia toothfish or near Heard Island. The logic behind that was that the government said, well, this company went to the trouble of finding the fish. They invested in searching for it, which is, of course, not really true, because they went on their first expedition and they couldn't find any fish there. They found them only during their second expedition, only because they saw some of the illegal operators and where they were fishing. So they put their lines down there and, to nobody's surprise, they were catching fish. But the government gave this right in perpetuity because the feeling was that if it was their property right forever, they would treat it like it was their own, and they would not take too many fish. They would take just the sustainable amount that would keep the habitat and the population going for the longest period of time. But the Australian government has not received a penny for the legally, or of course the illegally, harvested toothfish that's come from around Heard Island.
Now, what about in other countries? What about in the States here? What happens there?
Well, it ranges the gamut. It's there's sometimes, just a permit fee. There's sometimes based on tonnage. It's all over the board.
Yeah, well, it seemed to me, though, that the whole structure doesn't seem right, in terms of, it would seem to me that in terms of the money that there ought to be certain, paid, and then a certain percentage go back into, building the supply of fish or something or other. I mean, the whole system doesn't make sense.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, fish is different from other foods in this basic sense that we don't eat food that is caught from the wild except for fish anymore, generally speaking. I mean, obviously there's exceptions, but fish is the last food product that we catch in the wild in large quantities. And when you catch a fish in the wild, it is, unless you're paying some, permitting fee that's substantial, it's free, mm-hmm. which is completely different from, say, a farm where you're raising cows. Mm-hmm. You need to own the land, you need to feed the cows, you need to do all these things with the great expenses. And the comparison with the fish is, you just catch them. They're there for the taking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like the range. Okay, thank you.
All right, well, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. We also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. And if you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or on the Internet in the United States, use the toll-free line that is 800-222-9455. And again, our guest this morning, Bruce Necht, his book is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by the Rodale Press. He's a New York-based writer for the Wall Street Journal. There, I think now, particularly within the last couple of years, in media, we have started to see more stories about the problem of overfishing around the world. And certainly if you live in, say, a part of the United States, for example, where fishing has been a big industry, that's a local story too, because people simply, we have these guys who say, my grandfather fished and my father fished and I'm fishing now and I'm holding on barely. And even if my son wanted to, he can't. He couldn't do it because there aren't enough fish anymore. And we keep going out further and further, but there aren't enough fish. So that's something that's getting attention in the media. At the same time, I wonder how many people are really paying very much attention to that problem, and does it influence people's behavior when it comes to buying and eating fish?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the level of understanding about what fish is and where it comes from is pretty limited. I mean, we mentioned that Chilean sea bass has a name that isn't really terribly appropriate. That's not really anything new. There's a fish, no doubt, many listeners are familiar with called orange roughy. Mm-hmm. Orange roughy, before it took on that name, was called slimehead. It too comes from the southern hemisphere, and it too is the story of a great eating fish being given a marketing name and becoming incredibly popular, and it's also similar to toothfish in that it's particularly vulnerable. Toothfishes lives for a very long time, up to 50 years. It doesn't reproduce itself until it's 12 or 13. And it stays in one place. It lives in water up to a mile deep, and it stays in the same habitat for its entire life. So if you find where it lives and you attack it in this sort of industrialized method, it doesn't, the fish don't have a chance. The technology overwhelms them.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that you can do that for a while. You can get away with that for a while, but not forever.
Well, Antonio Perez, like a lot of fishermen, says, it really doesn't matter because, if one species is, difficult to find, well, there'll be another species out there, and we'll just switch. And for all of history, that seemed to be true. But one of the arguments I make in the book is that That is not true anymore. I think it's going to turn out to be that the Patagonia toothfish is the last large fish that has been discovered, and exists in significant quantities and can be harvested economically, that we're ever going to find. Mm-hmm. I mean, we literally had to go to the bottom of the earth to find it in incredibly deep water. We've covered the ocean. We've looked everywhere. There are fish that live, in the incredible depths, 3-4 miles in deep water. You've seen pictures of them. They have these sort of buggy eyes, and they're, no one has ever talked about eating those fish or finding a way to economically harvest them. I think the toothfish is in many ways sort of the end of the line.
So for this man, for example, who was the captain of this, the master of this boat, the Viarsa, and his mindset, and probably the mindset of a lot of other people still, is, look, the ocean is so vast, it's huge, and the amount of fish in there is huge, and they seem to act as if it was an inexhaustible resource, as if, there's no way we're ever going to catch all the fish in the ocean. Look how big it is. Look how many fish there are.
They act that way, and some of them may even believe it, but I think a lot of them probably, don't believe it, because they've seen what's happened, to places where they fish. They know better than anyone. And one of the things they know is that most of the ocean is desert-like, and that there's very little marine life in most of the ocean. Most fish live in coastal waters, the middle of the ocean, where the depths are enormous. That's where most of the volume of the ocean is, but it's not where the fish are.
Is this really the problem here, that there is a tremendous demand, and can you trace that back to people being told, all of us being told, that eating fish is good for you? So now people have said, okay, I'll eat fish.
Oh, absolutely. That has to contribute to it. That's going on, not just here, China, for instance, which, the economy there is booming, and the society is getting more affluent all the time. A lot of Patagonia toothfish was processed there for shipment to other countries to take advantage of the inexpensive labor there. But now the Chinese market is saying, well, we like this fish. Why don't we have some, too? So the demand is developing there. And the Chinese, too, know about the health benefits of fish. And as they more of them are able to afford it, the numbers are just staggering in terms of what that will add to the demand for seafood. Mm.
Let's talk with someone else here on a cell phone, calling our toll-free line. This is line 4. Hello.
Yes, fascinating program. And I just wanted to ask whether or not how much fish farming is developing, and is this somewhat equivalent of the fish that we're getting in the wild? I've heard many reports that there's a lot of mercury that these fish farmers are involved with, and their fish is not as healthy to eat as wild fish. And the second point I'd like to ask is, or suggest, is that since most of our fishing is done on the coastal waters, have they ever thought about some of these drones where they could patrol particular areas where these fish are at, to keep these illegal fishermen from over taking too much fish at a time? And I'd like to hear your comments.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, drones and planes, I think, have been used. Canada has even used submarines, which, of course, would be the perfect way to sort of pop up before they can have a chance to retrieve their lines. But that's the first part. The second part is you have to actually, arrest them. You have to get the evidence, then you have to arrest them, and then you have to force the vessel to go someplace that can enable the law enforcement people to get the crew, or at least the officers, into a courtroom. That's everything's difficult, and of course some of those other methods are extremely expensive. Now, farming of seafood, a lot of people think it is the answer, but it is flawed for a couple of reasons. One, you mentioned the environmental problems. There's PCBs in some farm fish. The reason for this is the water they live in, the environment they live in, because of their own waste and the food that they're fed is not very pleasant. You know, I've gone sailing near a salmon farm, and the air miles away smells bad. The other problem with farm fish is the farm fish that are most attractive, that are most popular, are fed ground up fish. So we're not actually solving the problem of not enough fish, because we're just killing fish to feed them to other fish.
Yeah, and apparently there are great concerns about the possibility that fish farms could be breeding grounds for disease that would then not just be a problem for the fish in the fish farm, but because there's no wall between the fish, that is in the fish that are out in salt water, they're
right
in these big pens. Well, there's no wall, there's no barrier between the fish inside and the fish outside. And there, some people are concerned that that could be breeding ground for disease that could then spread out and affect wild stocks of fish.
Absolutely. And I think there's evidence that that's happening.
We have about 10 minutes left, again, in this part of Focus 580, talking with Bruce Necht. He is the author of the book Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It is about the Chilean sea bass, better known as, well, perhaps less well known as the Patagonian toothfish, about the problem of overfishing, about this particular fish, taking this as a case study of what is a much larger problem and affects other fish as well. The book's published by Rodale, out now, and again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. How did you, I know that you've really touched on this, but and that part of your interest here is you're a sailor and you're interested probably in anything that has to do with boats, but how did you get onto this particular story and decide that you'd like to concentrate on this so much that you ended up writing a book?
Well, I'd like to. I wish I could tell you it was my idea, but it wasn't. I heard nothing about this chase, like most people in the U.S., until about 3 years ago. The Australian, the guy who runs the company that published my first book, The Proving Ground, in Australia, called me to tell me about this chase, and he told me, first about the sort of high seas adventure story that he thought would be the makings for a great book, but he also told me that, by the way, it's not really a sea bass, and by the way, most of it's caught illegally, and it was that sort of disconnect, that here this was, front page news in Australia, but yet the country that was getting the stuff, not really knowing what it was, didn't even know about this chase. We talk about the world getting to be a smaller place, but this was sort of this global disconnect, which when I started thinking about that, it took me a little while. I began to realize this really is a great idea for a book. So I took his idea and ran with it.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk with someone in Chicago. Line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes, hello. I'm calling actually from Palos Heights.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Just have a little vignette, a sad one and an amusing one. You talked about the concept of the fishermen believing there are more fish out there all the time. I talked to fishermen in the Northwest when I was vacationing there, and it went somewhat beyond that, in that their notion was, we'll catch them till they're gone, and we'll get another job. Which is, are you there?
Yeah, that's really sad that they would think that they just use up the resource and then go on to something else.
Yeah. They'll go work somewhere else. Yeah. There's trees, they'll work in a sawmill, if not, they'll go in a factory. I mean, this is just a story of one person, it's not a statistical study, but that is at least an attitude that exists. The other story is a little lighter. When you talked about eating jellyfish,
mm-hmm.
It must have been 20 years ago, I ordered jellyfish in a restaurant because I never saw it before. And this was a Chinese restaurant in Chicago. And I said, oh boy, I never heard of eating this. I heard of turtles eating it, but I was going to try it. And I guess I was very satisfied with what I received, but I was disappointed in that I did not get to eat jellyfish. If something sometimes happened in a Chinese restaurant, the menu is a little confusing in English, and it turned out to be jellied fish. It was a very delightful smoked fish in aspic, but I missed eating a jellyfish.
Well, maybe you should go back. Maybe they have the jellyfish now.
Maybe they really have got the jellyfish by now. Yes, I'm looking forward to that.
I was just going to say that the people who say, well, you know, we'll get another job, part of that, what he probably was thinking and maybe not saying, but certainly others have said it to me, is, well, you know what, if I don't catch it, somebody else will. It's going to be caught, so it might as well be me.
I hate to think about that, because most people are going to pass sooner or later, and would that be an excuse for cannibalism if you carry it to an extreme?
I think I'll
Sir?
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I was done. I didn't,
Okay. Good. Well, I appreciate the comments and the stories.
Okay, well, let's be on the lookout for real jellyfish, and if not, if you get a chance for smoked fish and aspic, it's quite good.
Okay. Well, thanks
bye-bye.
For the call. I didn't think anybody ate jellyfish, but you know, I suppose there's some place where there are people who
I
eat
think, in fact,
everything.
In China, it is something that people eat.
All right. Well, this I guess again, this gets us back to the sort of one of the bottom lines here is if this is something that you think is important, or we decide that it's important, that probably the best way to get at it is through getting people to change their getting consumers to change their attitudes and to get them to at least ask questions or think about where the food that they're eating, this where we're talking particularly here about fish, but getting people to think about where this comes from and what the environmental impact of producing it, whether it's farmed or whether it's well caught, you know, what the impact of that is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the only thing consumers can really do is ask questions when they go into a restaurant, you know, what is this fish really? Where does it come from? Is it fresh? Is it frozen? Do you know if it was caught legally? If Chilean sea bass is on the menu, you can, you know, ask those questions. And the questions, you know, you'll be asking a waiter, maybe you can ask to see the chef, and they may not really know the answers, or they may not tell you, you know, the truth, but you know, if people do ask the questions and the chefs and owners of restaurants begin to think that their customers care, they'll respond. They'll find a different kind of fish.
Hmm. And in the meantime, enforcement by governments, is that something that they're going to continue to do, but that it sounds like they're fighting the proverbial losing battle here?
Well, I think it has been a losing battle for a long time, but you know, if they were to give up, it would be much worse. It would be a rout.
So, what are you working on now? You have some new project going?
Well, I'm back at work at the Journal, and I would love to have another book to write, but I seem to be better at writing the books and coming up with ideas. So, I'm kind of in the market for an idea, and if anybody has one, I wish they'd let me know.
You still would like to stay with the sort of theme of boats and ocean sort
not
of stories?
Not necessarily. I like stories. I like writing books about, you know, real people and sort of that have a real strong narrative quality to them. But it doesn't have to be about the sea.
Yeah. How long did this project take? How long did you work on this?
About 18 months, all told.
Hmm. And did the paper give you the time off, essentially,
they
say,
did.
Okay, go ahead
they
and go
they
write your book?
They were very generous about it for both books, in fact.
And you no doubt did a lot of travel for this project as well.
I did. You know, that's one of the good things. You know, Australia is a wonderful place, and I took three long trips there for this book, and you know, that's a real delight. That was one of the pleasant things about the book.
Mm-hmm. So now, as you go around and you meet people and you talk about this issue, do you find yourself lecturing people about this particular issue? I mean, is that something that if you spend enough time with this story that and you've told the story in the book that you can't quite get rid of it and you end up in your day-to-day dealings with people, or maybe you're in a restaurant or whatever, that it's something that you feel like you almost have to talk about?
To a degree. You know, I also try to avoid talking about it too much. But you're right. It's something I've been deeply involved in, so I can't stop thinking about it on some level, I guess.
Yeah. So people haven't gotten to the point where they see you coming to think, oh God, here's Bruce.
No.
Here comes the toothfish guy.
I let them raise it.
All right. We'll talk with one more caller here in the time that remains. Chicago, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I wondered whether your guest was familiar with the work of David Conover at Stony Brook in New York, where he's been. He was the subject on All Things, I'm sorry, Morning Edition on Father's Day, where he talked about doing some evolution and showing that when we catch the big fish, the fish don't disappear, the others don't disappear, but the genes for staying small and safe take over. And whether that might be happening as well with the fish that he's talking about.
I think that happens whenever, one element of an ecosystem, whether it be in the water or on the land, is diminished. The others assume a different role, a larger role maybe, or maybe a smaller role if they're dependent on the larger species. I mean, you see it in your backyard when, one bush overtakes another bush. I think that's kind of the same. There's sort of a give and take going on all the time.
Well, it wasn't so much that it was one species taking the place of another. Rather, it was he had focused on the Atlantic silverside fish, which is a small fish. And schoolfish, but what he found was that if you take out the big ones, the little ones, the gene for being small is the factor that takes over, and so that you catch only the small fish. He has an artificial ocean in his laboratory, and if you go to the web, npr.org, and you can look for David Conover. I think you may find...
Yeah, I'm not familiar with his work. That's very interesting.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've got to jump in here. My apologies to the caller, but we've come to the end of the time, and we're going to have to finish. Again, if you want to read the book by our guest, Bruce Necht, it is Hooked, Pirates, Poaching, and the Perfect Fish. It's published by the Rodale Press. Bruce is a New York-based writer for the Wall Street Journal, and thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.